With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, this week's Almond Update with information on workshops coming up on managing key pests in your orchard. But we start today by continuing the conversation we've been having this week with Stanislaus County Agriculture Commissioner Linda Pinfold.
Let's talk about the Sustainable Pest Management Roadmap. What is that, and how can this benefit growers?
Well, that's a fine question. So the Sustainable Pest Management Roadmap, and I highly recommend that growers do go online and look this up. It's not regulation, it's not law, it's really a policy document. And when you look at it, it was developed, or it's been published by the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, but it partnered in putting it together and creating it. They partnered with California Department of Food and Agriculture, members of various industries in California, as well. They had a California Agricultural Commissioner as a representative there. They worked with a number of University of California and other research scientists. But basically, how I would define it when I look at it, to put it in the simplest of terms, is it's basically integrated pest management, but it's integrated pest management that also includes a social aspect to it. So it includes with it considerations of human health and social equity, as well as the things that growers focus on as well, which is environmental protections and economic vitality. So when you look at it, it focuses on things like impacts on community and equity. Linkages to broader environmental issues such as water conservation, biodiversity conservation, soil health, and climate impact, and as well includes a broader consideration of economic benefits and impacts. But it's something that is taking a viewpoint that looks at how things will be, not necessarily just right now, but really looking far into the future for 2050. Some of the things that it talks about, though, I can see that, growers in the farming community have very strong concerns about, because it brings into light questions as to how important tools, specifically pesticides, will be impacted and what tools will still be made available. So when you look at the Sustainable Pest Roadmap, the goals that it talks about is that by 2050, I'm just going to kind of read this off here, 2050 pest management that includes two primary goals. So the first goal is to eliminate the use of priority pesticides in California by transitioning to sustainable pest management practices. And so how priority pesticides are referred to or defined is that they're pesticide products, active ingredients, and groups of related products within the context of specific product uses or pest and location use combinations that have been deemed to be of greatest concern and warrant heightened attention, planning, and support to expedite their replacement and eventual elimination. Currently, there's a number of pesticides. I would dare to say that probably a number of the what we have here in California is California restricted pesticides. These are pesticides that probably would meet this definition. I think my personal opinion is that the challenge is going to be you know, that as we're looking at these, what tools are still going to be available that will be effective to support a strong industry. So, for example, we talk about neonicotinoids. You know, I know that that's something that's getting more and more regulation, and that's one of these things that maybe might down the road fit this definition. But as of right now, there are certain pesticides like neonicotinoids that they're really the only solution that is available. So, for example, with tomatoes, they have they deal with a virus called curly top virus that is vectored by certain types of sharpshooters. The most effective pesticide to be able to control them, especially in the early stages after planting tomatoes, is neonicotinoids. And so it's the best tool in the toolbox to be able to control that. So from what I hear talking with growers and industry, this is one that is of critical concern because if you don't have certain tools, there needs to be more research, and we need to make sure that there's good, strong tools available if we're going to be taking certain tools out of the toolbox, so to speak. As well, the second goal for this as well is that sustainable pest management will be adopted and will be the de facto pest management system in California by 2025. So a priority outcome of these goals ultimately is to eliminate the adverse human health and environmental impacts associated with pesticides.
We will conclude the conversation later in this show. This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. You are listening to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the American Farm Bureau Federation is urging lawmakers to fund the federal government by passing the minibus funding bill. Michael Clements shares more.
As yet another federal funding deadline looms, the American Farm Bureau Federation encourages Congress to pass a series of funding bills this week. AFBF Government Affairs Director Emily Buckman explains.
Well, over the weekend, Congress released text of a sixth bill minibus, which also includes the agriculture funding bill. AFBF would like to see the government funded and would like to see the minibus passed by Congress this week. So we did take action and sent a letter urging all members of Congress to support the minibus, which would avoid a partial shutdown.
Buckman says a federal government shutdown of any kind is a no-win situation for everyone.
We clearly do not benefit from a shutdown. Farmers wouldn't be able to take out loans, including mortgage loans, crop loans. It would impact disaster payments. USDA offices across the country would be hit. So we want to see the government funded. We want to move past fiscal year 2024 appropriations so that we can move forward on other pieces of legislation like the Farm Bill.
She encourages farmers and ranchers to contact their lawmakers on the issue.
Farm Bureau members should ask Congress to fund the federal government to avoid a partial shutdown, which could happen this Friday if Congress does not pass a minibus. We encourage our members to reach out to their congressional delegations and ask Congress to fund the federal government.
Michael Clements, Washington.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, the U.S. cattle herd is still at record low levels. Kevin Good, Vice President of Industry Relations for Cattle Facts, says the U.S. herd is still at levels not seen for decades.
I think you start out with the total herd, which is historically low. As you think about the inventory report from January 1, which is the lowest that we've had since back in the 50s. So you've got a herd that's historically low in total, but you continue as a long-term trend to continue to lock up more of them on feed or a higher percentage. I think there's a message there of the available supplies, more of them are on feed. The February 1st on feed number was even with a year ago and only down 1% compared to the five-year average, which means the available supplies outside of feed yards as far as feeder cattle and calves are down 1 million head. And that's not counting the reduction in cows and all that.
Producers are feeding smaller numbers of cattle for longer periods of time.
I think there is a message there that more of them are locked up, but as a trend, there's less of them, and we tend to feed cattle longer. So even if you've got an on-feed number that's, let's say, even year over year, you're still going to market a couple percent less, just because we have a tendency, long-term trend, to feed cattle longer and to heavier weights.
producers aren't holding any extra heifers back for breeding yet.
Still liquidating, and I think you can approach that conversation two ways. On the heifer side, you still have about 40% of your on-feed population is heifers, and so that would indicate that you're still liquidating on the heifer side, so we're not expanding there yet. On the cow side, cow slaughter is declining, but it still is at a liquidation pace, just a much slower liquidation pace this year compared to last year. And that's for the beef cows. We're starting to do a little bit of expansion in the dairy industry so far this year compared to some contraction last year.
Record beef prices won't incentivize expansion until some of the other headwinds disappear.
Record high prices, but you got to have feed for the cattle, so it's drought driven. Even though we've gotten ourselves better shape second half of last year through the winter with drought, I mean, we've had 3 years of massive drought, so that would be the top of the list why we haven't expanded yet. You can go into a lot of other lists. Labor availability, cost of labor, interest rates are high, availability of capital, urban sprawl, alternative land use, all those would contribute to lack of optimism as far as expanding. We will expand. Prices will get high enough that it'll incentivize expansion. It's just going to take longer.
That was Kevin Good of Cattle Facts. In other livestock news, the American Sheep Industry Association submitted an application for RAP funding. Consideration of proposals for the new U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Agriculture Service Regional Agricultural Promotions Program is underway. The American Sheep Industry Association submitted an application for RAP in early February that would expand its current international marketing programs and look at potential in newer markets. RAP was created to foster market diversification and thus exclude the markets of Canada, Mexico, the European Union, and China, at least during the first tranche of funding. USDA says it expects to award up to $300 million in funding during the first tranche. It hopes to make funding available to participants by June 1st. In total, RAP will make $1.2 billion available for investments in international marketing during the 5 years of the program. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The Biden administration has launched another effort to address inflation challenges and help mitigate the high prices that consumers are struggling with. During a White House meeting of his Competition Council, President Joe Biden announced the creation of a Competition and Price Strike Force.
No matter how much money you make, no matter how rich or poor or middle class you are, you don't like being taken advantage of. That's why today I'm launching a new strike force on unfair and illegal pricing. To crack down on companies who break the law while keeping prices high for American consumers. The new strike force will be led by the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. If you keep prices high while engaging in illegal practices that are fraudulent or unfair or deceptive or anti-competitive, we will enforce the law. We will enforce the law.
The deadline is quickly approaching for enrolling in USDA's agriculture risk coverage or price loss coverage programs for the 2024 crop year. These programs offer income support to farmers who experience significant declines in crop prices or revenues. Enrollment and signed contracts for the programs are required annually. Producers can choose between ARC County, ARC Individual, or PLC coverage options. Producers have until March 15th to revise elections and sign contracts. Failure to meet the deadline means exclusion from ARC or PLC and potential payment loss. Enrolling in ARC or PLC may affect eligibility for certain crop insurance products, and web-based decision tools are available to assist producers in making informed choices. Producers can access more information through USDA's website or local USDA service centers. The California Rice Commission is reminding industry members about a program opportunity funded by the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Rice fields are being sought for enrolling in a program that aims to pay eligible rice farmers $33.78 per acre to leave vegetation undisturbed from April 1st to July 15th, the waterfowl nesting season. To be eligible, fields must be idled during the 2024 growing season and have cover crops or significant volunteer vegetation suitable for nesting birds. Farmers must also have brood water nearby until July 15th. Notably, the program aligns with a recent policy change allowing farmers to transfer water while leaving vegetation for nesting birds, a temporary modification applicable only to transfers in 2024. Interested growers can contact the California Rice Commission or visit their local NRCS office to apply. The 2024 Ag Legacy Symposium is coming up Saturday, March 16th. The one-day event is meant to help prepare a farm, ranch, or agribusiness for the transition to the next generation. Speakers include extension specialists from the University of Wyoming and Colorado State University, a partner at Hyatt McIntyre & Associates, and two area farmers. The succession planning workshop is set to begin at 9 a.m. at the Sierra Valley Grange Hall in Vinton. The sessions will cover legal aspects, financial topics, political factors, family dynamics, and provide real-life scenarios to consider incorporating into succession planning. Alameda County rancher Tim Koopman and Butte County farmer Ryan Shore will both be talking about tools they've used for estate planning, which includes conservation approaches and working with a team of trusted advisors. More information on the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
An expiring estate tax could be very costly for farm estates. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act significantly changed federal individual income and estate tax policies, though some were temporary. In 2018, the legislation increased the estate tax exemption amount from $5.49 million to $11.18 million. This increase expires at the end of 2025. The exclusion amount would revert in 2026 to $6.98 million per deceased person. Researchers with USDA's Economic Research Service estimates that the expiring increased exemption would be $13.95 million per person at the time of expiration. Lowering the estate tax exemption level in 2026 could increase the percentage of farm operator estates taxed from 0.3 to 1. Large farms would experience the largest increase in the share of estates that owe estate tax, increasing from 2.8 to 7.3%. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. A new report can help farmers analyze their crop risks and opportunities. Michael Clements reports.
Pattern Ag uses analytics to help farmers optimize their spending on crop protection, seed selection, and fertility inputs while improving the long-term productivity of their land. Danielle Watts, VP of Data, Pattern Ag, says the 2024 Predictive Ag Report is backed by a large amount of data.
We analyzed more than 200 billion genetic reads from soil samples taken across the Midwest, and they form a soil metagenomics database, which is the world's largest soil metagenomic database. We put all of that information together and package that into our predictive ag report. One of the key ways in which we really drive our understanding of what's happening in these fields is through a large research program we have. It's called the Pattern Ag Growers Initiative, where we're working directly with commercial growers to understand the impacts of their field management on the soil biology, as well as what sort of links there are between the soil biology and their yield outcome.
The Soil Productivity Index provides benchmarks of yield potential for farmers to compare their fields against.
So what we've done is taken years of grower information, including yield, as well as all of their soil biology and chemistry, and put that together in a way that really helps explain how far off are you from the potential yields that you could be getting. Are you pretty much maximizing out the yield through your management practices of the soil in your farm, or are there opportunities for you to dive in a level deeper and really increase your soil productivity potential?
The report can help growers make crop input decisions for the growing season.
We produce an almanac every year where we're pinpointing the regions with the highest risk of pest and pathogen outbreaks. And these are really detailed maps that are going to look at pathogens as well as what sort of upcoming risks we're seeing in terms of biofertility. And then diving a layer deeper this year, we've also released a bunch of foliar insights. So where are we seeing regions of high foliar pathogen loads? We're also providing a lot of insights about where we're seeing significant yield differences based on the pathogen loads in the field. So this year is a sort of new release around that where we're able to say, here's where we're seeing significant yield losses.
This is the second year that Pattern Ag has published the Predictive Ag Report. Watts offers an example of what growers can expect.
We saw something really interesting going on in north central Iowa in particular, where we were seeing between 30 and 80 bushels per acre lower corn in fields that were really high risk for fusarium root rot, northern corn leaf blight, tar spot, and anthracnose of corn. Since the average yield for corn in this region is around 200 bushels per acre, our growers in that region where we saw low fusarium, they were upwards around 240 bushels per acre. And in contrast, fields really high in fusarium were averaging about 150 bushels per acre in 2023. What that tells us is that there's a really significant opportunity to be a little bit more aggressive in the management of some of these root rots to achieve that top end yield that's possible in that region.
Copies of the 2024 Predictive Ag Report can be downloaded online at www.pattern.ag. Michael Clements reporting.
What does the end of February's U.S. Drought Monitor reveal about coverage in areas preparing for spring crop planting? Rod Bain reports.
Meteorological spring is here, with the spring equinox soon to follow. That also means crop planting is underway, or fast approaching, in parts of the country, such as the Deep South. Are planting conditions favorable from a drought coverage perspective? As reported in the U.S. Drought Monitor, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at the February 27th edition of the Monitor and notes what drought coverage looks like for various crops.
We're still a few weeks away from planting, of course, in the heart of the Midwest, but it is worth noting that drought coverage for the corn production area stands at 30%, soybeans 28% of the production area in drought. That is down significantly from last year's peaks, 70% for corn in June of 2023, 63% for soybeans also in June of 2023.
He adds other commodities have seen significant year-over-year decreases in drought coverage.
Sorghum, a year ago, 86% of the production area was in drought. That number currently stands at 13%. And for cotton, 45% of the production area in drought a year ago, 11% as we start March of 2024.
What about crops and commodities active this time of year? Rippey says for the main crop in that category, winter wheat,
54% of the winter wheat crop was in drought a year ago. That number was as high as 49% during planting in October of 2023, but the current figure stands at just 14% of the U.S. winter wheat crop in drought.
As for hay and drought coverage,
hay production area in drought for the United States has been halved over the last year, going from 34 to 17%. Worth noting that sometimes with the hay production, it's slow to recover after a drought. We're still waiting for some of that recovery in some of the hardest hit areas, especially in the southern United States. But in time, as long as moisture keeps coming, we should see some nice recovery this spring and summer in some of those southern drought affected areas.
And finally, regarding drought and the nation's cattle inventory,
it's been cut by two-thirds over the last year, 48% in drought a year ago. That number, as we enter March 2024, stands at just 16%.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Are you looking for someone to prepare your tax returns? Gary Crawford talks with an expert who has some advice for choosing a preparer.
And now, it's tax time with classic comedians Bud Abbott and Lou Costello.
Well, Costello, here's the income tax accountant my brother recommended. Now, let's go in and see him.
Aha, gentlemen!
Mr. Costello here wants you to help him with his income tax.
Fine, fine. Now, Mr. Costello, how much money did you make last year?
Well, I...
Speak right up, young man. Speak right up. All this information is confidential.
Well, I made...
Tell me about it. Tell me. How much did you make?
Well, it was an...
Come! Has a cat got your tongue? Get the marbles out of your mouth.
Oh, he's gone and lost his marbles. But anyway.
Finding a tax preparer that you trust and that you can ask questions to, I think, is really important.
And that one in the skit there, not a good choice for a tax preparer, right?
That's right.
That's right. Kansas State University Extension tax expert Susie Latta, and she's got a whole lot of advice for you if you are looking for somebody to prepare your taxes. So, Susie, first, what qualities should we look for in a tax preparer?
Well, I think you need to find somebody that you can trust, somebody that's credentialed, that knows what they're doing. I think it's important that, you know, you feel like you can be honest and you feel like the information that they're providing you is correct.
Yeah, and we'll let you get a word in edgewise. Now, right about this time every year, there are signs that you see going up, new signs advertising tax help, and storefronts that were vacant last month suddenly become tax preparing centers. Now, these could be legitimate or maybe not. Susie, your advice on that?
If they're just a pop-up, if they're not at the location year-round, you know, that might be something I'd be a little skeptical about, or I definitely, if I was going to use that tax preparer to make sure that I find out if something happens in the off-season, you get a letter from the IRS, so in case you have other tax questions or finance questions that are related to your taxes. So you have to have somebody that you know is going to be there, is going to be there for a long time, that you feel confident and trust and that they know what they're doing.
And she says don't just pick the first preparer that you run into. Check a few out.
You know, maybe ask them some questions, interview them, find out in advance how they charge, how much it's going to cost.
So choose a tax preparer that you really trust that is definitely going to be there for you in case the IRS finds a problem with your return.
A tax preparer can make or break you, because you need to know that if you get a letter from the IRS that they're there to defend you in the event that you need an audit or something like that.
And Susie says if you are still unsure about which preparer to use, there's one more way that could help you decide.
The best advertisement is really word of mouth. And so I encourage people to talk to their friends and neighbors and people that they trust and find out, you know, who they use.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Brian German with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Outreach and education specialist with the Almond Board, Gary Castillo, joins us today to talk about some upcoming workshops the Almond Board is hosting in the coming weeks. And so, Gary, let's start out with an overview of what these events are going to cover and how they came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So this series of events is titled Management of Key Pests in Your Orchard. And this was put together kind of as an idea between me and Lauren Fan, who is the senior specialist of pest management at the Almond Board. These events will be held from 8:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. with check-in at 8:15. And roughly we're kind of expecting between 20 to 40 people at these events.
And now there's multiple events as part of this series at various locations. And so where and when are these going to be taking place?
So we'll be at a series of four locations up and down the valley. And we'll start off next Tuesday, March 12th. We'll be up in Orland at the Glen Success Conference Center, which is located at 131 East Walker Street, Orland, California. And then following that, the next day we'll be at the Stanislaus County Harvest Hall on March 13th at 3800 Cornucopia Way, Modesto, California. And then we'll take a couple weeks off of that and pick back up the beginning of April 2nd, where we will be at the Merced County Farm Bureau, which is located at 646 South Highway 59 in Merced, California. Finishing up on April 3rd, the next day, we will be at Kern County Ag Pavilion down in Bakersfield at 3300 East Bell Terrace in Bakersfield, California.
So plenty of opportunities to come out and check one of these workshops out. And really, no matter where you're at in the state, there's one pretty close by. And now you noted that these are going to be focused on pests that growers are dealing with. And so what are some of the specific topics and maybe some of the speakers that are going to be part of these workshops?
Yeah, absolutely. So the speakers are going to cover integrated pest management practices that'll be for new and emerging insect pests in almond orchards. Some of those will be stink bugs, navel orangeworm, and the new Carpophilus beetle, as well as some timely information on monitoring and control of those species. And then we'll also have some information about IPM incentives that are offered through EQIP. And then we'll have a numerous amount of speakers ranging from Lauren Fan from the Almond Board, Abigail Welsh from Simios, Thomas Martin from Trace, Houston Wilson from UC Riverside, David Haviland and Jalindra from UC A&R, and then Jesse Roseman from the Almond Board as well.
So a pretty robust agenda there for these workshops, plenty of opportunity to learn some important points about IPM. And with so much to be covered here in these events, are there going to be any kind of education units available?
Yes, absolutely. So we will have 2.5 hours of the other category for DPR at these sessions.
Now, with what's going to be covered at these events, who's sort of the target audience or who might be best served by coming out and participating?
Yeah, I'd say the target audience for this is anybody that's involved in some of the pest management decisions inside the field. That can range from PCAs to growers, as well as anybody kind of involved in that decision-making process. And I definitely would say, you know, with these events being from around 20 to 40 people, don't be afraid to ask questions. These are more of an intimate event, so definitely feel free to ask some questions if you have anything in any of these topics. And with some of these smaller events that we put on, we definitely encourage engagement from the audience. That way people could answer questions, kind of get some transfer of maybe, you know, what people are seeing in different areas and how people have been able to handle some of those issues.
Very good. And now just lastly here, where can people get some of the particulars, learn if there's any costs, or get signed up for these?
So the cost for these events is free to attend. All we ask is that you just RSVP, and that can be done by going to almonds.com/events. And then once you get to that, it'll be a calendar and just kind of scroll down to the appropriate date that you're thinking about attending and click on the link, and that will bring you to the registration page where you can find out all the information, the addresses as well, and which days to attend.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
We'll be right back. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now to wrap up our show, we conclude our conversation with Stanislaus County Ag Commissioner Linda Penfold. I wanted to also ask you about the statewide pesticide notification and what this means for growers, but also what this means for residents.
So that's a good question. So a little history. So in 2021, the legislature set aside $10 million and directed California Department of Pesticide Regulation to develop a statewide notification system within 4 years. So in other words, the goal here is that California Department of Pesticide anticipates the implementation of the statewide pesticide program notification program by the end of this year. So where things are right now is California Department of Pesticide has actually developed a notification system. It's called Spray Days, and it's in place to provide public with advanced, transparent, and equitable access to information about pesticide applications. The purpose of this notification system is to complement existing pesticide laws and regulations that govern safe, legal application of pesticides and protect public health and the environment. So long and the short of it, what this system does is when growers submit notices of intent for use of California restricted pesticides, that notifications will be essentially used as a public record and posted. Right now, from what I have seen of the beta of Spray Days, it shows just based on the on a mile grid, which is using the township's range and section system, it just shows what pesticides have been proposed for use within that square mile. The method and I believe the time that the notification was submitted. It does not show the exact location of where the pesticide is being applied, although there has been public comment and there is a lot of interest by the public towards asking for location information. However, at right now, based off of industry concerns, and frankly, I'll be honest, the agriculture commissioners are strongly advising as well, that for right now, at least, let's get, you know, if we're going to be giving this a try, let's work with just getting the information, because the whole goal here is that if people are concerned about pesticide use around where they live, they can be able to know what's being applied in where they live, and then they can make good decisions as to closing the doors, bringing things inside, making sure their pets are inside, so they can make sure that they feel safe and protecting their property and family and pets. So where things are right now is it's been getting beta tested in Tulare. I believe the beta testing started in October and has recently concluded. I understand there's about 150 participants in the beta testing, but although this isn't developed, spray days is developed, it's not been released as of yet. Also, what's happened fairly recently, there also was public comment. The public comment period ran from November up through January. As well, DPR had three public hearings in December. So right now, from what I understand, California Department of Pesticide Regulation is reviewing those comments that they received and are looking at how they're going to move forward. But one thing that is going to be coming from this, as I understand, is there's proposed regulations, and I believe people can actually have those proposed regulations published online. And what I understand those proposed regulations will do, if enacted, is that the Department of Pesticide, will make notice, will require notices of intent, will provide notices of intent information it receives as publicly available. All notices of intent for use in production agriculture will be required to be electronically submitted to the local county agricultural commission. Certain notices of intent information to be submitted to DPR will be also provided through the electronic system. The specific information and timeframes of when a notice of intent for soil fumigation will also be provided in those regulations. And last but not least, the Department of Pesticide Regulation will be required to evaluate its system and process for making the information available and will be issuing the report 3 years after the system is implemented.
So again, that's a lot for people who are listening, and can they? It's a lot. I'm surprised that you're able to even get all this out. But for people who are listening, can they find that information again online somewhere?
Yes. Here again, the easiest thing to do: Google is your friend. But just go on to Google or whatever your search site is, and put in California Department of Pesticide Regulation. Or you can even just put in California and then put in statewide pesticide notification system. Chances are, even if you just put in pesticide notification system, it will bring you to all of the information that's there.
Thank you once again to Stanislaus County Ag Commissioner Linda Pinfold. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.